Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, the post-Super Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives, the first two dealing with Super Tuesday. Ian, you may want to cover your ears because somehow this is starting the good martini.
What a Super Tuesday!
I know you're trying to limit your exposure to Hillary Clinton, especially speaking loudly in case she actually wins this thing and you have to deal with it every day for four or eight years. A good night, obviously, for the front runners in both parties. Donald Trump wins seven states for the Republicans, and Hillary Clinton wins seven states for the Democrats. But a lot of folks thought it was going to be even more dominant. That's about the best positive spin we can put on this, unless you actually like those candidates. Hillary Clinton losing, obviously, in Vermont, where Bernie Sanders won big. But he also won in Oklahoma, as well as the caucuses in Minnesota and Colorado. Trump, as we said, won seven states, but Cruz was able to win quite decisively in his home state of Texas and also in Oklahoma. Came very close in Arkansas, but did not win. But he did score the all-important Alaska caucus, and Marco Rubio did win up in Minnesota. So the narrative, the delegate proportion hasn't changed a lot. There's still an uphill climb to stop both of these people. But given the expectations a lot of people had going in, that in some cases some thought Trump might even be able to run the table, it's a better night than we feared.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Donald Trump is certainly dominant in a couple states, had absolutely more or less crushing victories. I mean, Massachusetts, he won 49.5% of the vote. And I think John Kasich was in second with 17 or something like that. That's just sort of an extraordinary result. I think he also had a similar result in Alabama. But all of that said, yeah, look, yesterday we were hearing that Donald Trump would probably win everywhere but Texas. He would potentially sweep, that Ted Cruz, his best bet was Texas alone, that Marco Rubio didn't have a shot in many of these places, that he's waiting until the 8th or the 15th. None of that turned out to be true. I think we saw last night that we may have underestimated Cruz's appeal. My own feeling is that Cruz is a very good retail politician. That was his ability to woo people one-on-one, I think, was very effective in Iowa, which is one of the reasons he won there. And one of the reasons he won in Texas and Oklahoma, obviously he had a structural advantage in Texas, but you don't win by 20 points with people just grudgingly voting for you. The Rubio campaign has a lot of cleanup work to do, but he ran basically even with Trump in Virginia. And while obviously would have been better for him to decisively win, they effectively split the delegate count there. And he won Minnesota, which retires the, you know, when's Marco Rubio going to win a state line. No significant victories, nothing that really sort of changes the prospects of the race, I think. But all things considered, Trump is not inevitable, and it's still too early to be talking about him as the quote-unquote presumptive frontrunner.
That is definitely a big takeaway, certainly not to the extent that Hillary is on the Democratic side with a huge now pledged delegate lead, and not to mention the hundreds and hundreds of superdelegates that she's already racked up. But on to the bad martini now, Ian, because we've been talking for a while now about the best option for conservatives is to narrow this down potentially to a two at the most three-person race. And after last night, that's not going to happen anytime soon. It should be blatantly obvious to Ben Carson after he out last night that this just isn't going to happen. His own campaign admits there's no path for him to win the nomination. But hey, there's still money in the bank, so we're still going to do this and grab 5, 6, 7% all across the board here. But here's the other problem. Both Cruz and Rubio can say that they made progress last night. First of all, here's Cruz after winning in Texas and Oklahoma and before he actually was declared the winner in Alaska.
Republicans, together we have a choice. We are blessed with a deep, talented, honorable field. For the candidates who have not yet won a state, who have not racked up significant delegates, I ask you to prayerfully consider our coming together.
And so then there's Marco Rubio, who later in the night did win in Minnesota. And he's looking at the numbers, probably in Virginia most exclusively, but also some other states where he's polled a lot better than what a lot of the most recent surveys suggested he would. So he says, no, I'm the guy on the upswing here.
We are seeing in state after state his numbers coming down, our numbers going up. And 2 weeks from tonight, right here in Florida, we are going to send a message loud and clear. We are going to send the message that the party of Lincoln and Reagan and the presidency of the United States will never be held by a con artist.
So basically, they're both saying they're the one who should be in that one-on-one matchup with Donald Trump. And Ian, really, both of them have fairly decent arguments. Cruz can say, look, I've won four times now. You've only won once, and you're behind in your home state of Florida. We'll see what happens there in a couple of weeks. I'm the one who can probably, if I was actually able to eclipse Donald Trump, have a better time smoothing things over with his supporters. Rubio can say, look, Super Tuesday was deep south for a lot of these different states. That should have been your bread and butter. In a lot of these states, you got completely smoked. I match up best with Trump overall and in some of these states coming forward. John Kasich, of course, is waiting for Ohio, and who knows what Ben Carson's really up to. So ultimately, Ian, this Donald Trump winning 35-40% of the vote looks like it's going to keep working, and it's going to keep working in states where it's winner take all pretty soon.
Despite the good things that did happen last night, from sort of a strictly electoral perspective, I think it leaves the race perhaps a little hazier as to what the best course of action is for anti-Trump folks at this point. I mean, Cruz is right. He's the leading anti-Trump candidate. He's also had his best states and is unlikely to perform as well in the states that are up on the 8th and the 15th. He might do okay in some of these states that are up on a Saturday, you know, Kentucky among them, but he's, to a certain extent, has to overestimate his future potential. And Rubio is effectively running on, I'm going to do better, trust me. And that's a very dangerous position to be in. Many would say he underperformed in Virginia. That was a state where he should have done better. He won by 7 in Minnesota, but he won over Ted Cruz. So if either of these guys or Kasich or Carson dropped out, would there be the type of consolidation Republicans have sort of theorized could stop Donald Trump? It's not clear, which means that the alternative is all of these guys try to fight it out until the convention and keep Donald Trump under the delegate threshold and then win that on the floor, which is a course of action that's very fragile and, of course, requires that Trump doesn't just crush some of these winner-take-all states later in the schedule. I think some people were hoping that last night would be somewhat clarifying as to, you know, if you're against Donald Trump, maybe Super Tuesday will give us a better indication of what the best path forward is. Maybe one of these guys will be spurred to drop out, consolidate, you know, et cetera. Or it will make clear that we're going to fight this to the convention. I'm not sure that it did either of those. And so it's very hazy what happens going forward. The only thing I can say with confidence is that Ben Carson is in a state of pathological denial.
All right, on to the crazy martini now. And this has nothing to do with Super Tuesday or the presidential race. Ian, it's just interesting how these stories involving the Ivy League seem to pop up on days where you're with us. And last time it was you had actually been up there with that whole upheaval about safe spaces at Yale and so forth. Well, now it's not just Yale. It's the entire Ivy League. Football coaches in the Ivy League unanimously decided to remove tackling from regular season practices, according to a Tuesday report from the New York Times. They made the decision in an attempt to further limit players' chances of suffering head and brain injuries. No tackling in practice is an extreme decrease from NCAA regulations, which state there can be 4 full contact practices each week, but it's a decisive stance on a subject that's plagued the game of football. According to a report by Al Jazeera, in December 2015, there were 501 reported concussions in the past 3 college football seasons. Here's the best part, though. Dartmouth head coach Buddy Tevens telling the New York Times, quote, at this stage in their careers, these guys know how to hit and take a hit. People look at it and say we're nuts, but it's kept my guys healthy. So, Ian, blocking and tackling, kind of important when it comes to football. Both of those, as far as I can tell, involve contact. And if this, in fact, is proven to be an effective way to have good football teams, Well, then, I think Allen Iverson is owed a deep, deep apology for that rant he had years ago about needing to go to practice.
I mean, in Dartmouth's defense, they won the Ivy League championship last year. So, maybe there's a strategy here. I don't know. I'm sympathetic to this desire. I wrote a piece about football and, the concussion problem and aggression and all the rest in the magazine 2 summers ago, I think it was now. So I'm sympathetic to this. The obvious retort, though, is that tackling in football is kind of like checking in hockey. You know, I mean, it's sort of the game, and it's rather silly to me to think that these teams are going to be able to perform particularly well if they remove from the practice schedule, half of the game. In the Ivy League's defense, though, it's not exactly like Harvard was going to be contesting Alabama and OU for the championship, in years to come. And also in the Ivy League's defense, I think the most precious assets are in these guys' heads and not in their biceps. So, maybe this is like a smart way to ensure their future earning potential. Maybe the Ivy League has actually made a wise decision in the interests of their players.
It could be. And we'll see over time whether the numbers decrease. It just seems to me that if you're used to having at least some contact, you'll know better how to brace yourself and prepare yourself. And the Dartmouth coach there is saying these guys know how to take a hit. But if you're not used to it and you only get it on Saturdays, I can see situations where guys could potentially increase the risk of injury. Ian, not the results we expected on Super Tuesday, and not exactly the report you would expect from football coaches. But the news goes on, and we'll do it again tomorrow. Talk to you then.
Indeed. Sounds good, Greg. Thanks.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and please tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.